We acknowledge the lives lost to suicide and recognize those who have survived suicide attempts and those who struggle today or in the past with thoughts of suicide, mental health issues, and crisis situations. We acknowledge all those who have felt the deep impact of suicide, including those who love, care, and support people experiencing suicidality and those experiencing the pain and bereavement through suicide. We respect collaboration with people who have a lived or living experience of suicide and mental health issues and value their contribution to the work we do.
The first attempt, the family didn't mention it. It was just all washed under the carpet. And I think that in itself felt like it was punishment and it was like letting the stigma rule.
Welcome to Holding On to Hope, a series that shares the stories of everyday Australians that have experienced moments in crisis and found a path to support. Whilst all of the stories shared offer hope and inspiration, at times you may hear something you find triggering. If you or someone you know needs crisis support, please phone Lifeline on 13 11 14, text 0477 13 11 14, or visit lifeline.org.au/get help for Lifeline chat service, which is 24/7.
Hello, and thank you for joining me. I'm Ruben, and I'm a volunteer telephone crisis supporter at Lifeline. I'm one of the voices you may hear if you call for support. At the age of 15, I lost my dear father to suicide. Ever since that fateful day, I always wished my father had the opportunity to talk to someone like me when he needed it the most. 13 years later and 4 years into my journey with Lifeline, I'm now part of that opportunity, and this is why I'm so passionate about hosting this series. If you're not quite ready to talk, perhaps you'll find comfort by listening to the stories of people who have experienced the value of reaching out for help. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Leah. Having found out in the most awful fashion she was adopted, Leah struggled with challenges throughout high school. Faced with crippling depression and societal stigma, she grappled with finding her place in the world. As a mother of two boys, she wore a mask and struggled alone. She is passionate about an individualized approach to treatment, finding your own coping strategies, and the importance of feeling empowered. Leah is joining us today to talk about her lived experience of mental health issues and to share her personal story and the moment her life changed for the better. Hi, Leah. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
If you could take me back to the time when you found out that you were adopted and what was going on during that time.
I was trying to remember the age group, but I think I was in about third class, so probably about 7 or 8. And it was in a very small school in the New England area. It was a time when you thought your friends were your friends. We were out there playing, and I can remember distinctly the hula hoop. It was a hula top times, and they were wooden at the time. This words come out of her mouth and said, she just decided she would pick on me this day, and ha-ha, you're adopted. I don't think that she knew what that word meant, and I certainly didn't. So it was a little bit dramatic. I was just a bit lost, I think, in that feeling. When I think about it now, I think, you know, parents do talk when you've just moved to the area and they hear that. So that's something that sticks in your mind, I guess, because I don't think that the young person knew that was it something was wrong with me or something about me. I have no idea. But and to this day, we've never discussed it. I see it from time to time, but we've never discussed it.
When you were at school during that time and, you know, being in the part of Australia that you were, was there stigma attached to being adopted?
I don't know whether it's stigma or what it is. It's that you're different and you really don't belong in that family. So I guess it is a stigma if you look at it that way. It felt that I was different to everybody else. And I think that, and I didn't know anybody else that was adopted. But it was a really horrible time, and it all stemmed from that moment in time in the playground. And I just don't think any 8-year-old should go through that alone. It was quite hard, and I'm sure it was very hard for my adoptive parents.
What were the kinds of thoughts and feelings, and probably to pinpoint that, when you found out the news that you were adopted?
I just can't remember the conversation with my parents, but the feelings I do remember, the devastation, trying to work out who these people were and who was I. It was all that talk about where do I fit in then, you know. So I, and as a young child, it was really quite hard to take on. And then the parents decide how much information you can take on. I just remember being devastated, absolutely devastated that I didn't belong to these people that I'd grown up with all this time. And it was like I was living a lie, I think. And I think, where do I belong? who do I belong to? Where do I fit? And the response from my dear dad was, you belong here with us. I knew I was different. You know, once the second child, you know, well, I was the first, and once the second, who was a natural child, came along, you could tell the difference, the absolute difference. I grew up looking totally different to everyone else. So, and I think that I would have gathered that had I not been told that at that time. And I think that they were waiting to the high school years to tell me I went a little bit older, a little bit more able to take on the information, I guess.
Can you tell us about the criticism and the judgment you faced when you became suicidal?
The problems I was having, no one knew that I was depressed. You put on that chameleon suit, I think, and trying to act normal. After the first attempt, the family didn't mention it. It was just all washed under the carpet and it wasn't mentioned at all. No discussion happened at all. And I think that in itself felt like it was punishment, it was judgment, and it was like letting the stigma rule. It was so long back in the 1970s, no one knew what to do. No one knew how to do it. And I didn't know there was such a thing as stigma about it. And I didn't know there was such a thing as suicide. It was just I wanted the end of pain. I wanted to get out of the circle. So they really were letting the stigma rule them without them knowing. Does that make sense?
No, it does. It does. And I suppose to look at it from my end, I probably fit in the Gen Z category, I think. Born in 95 and looking at how far we've come with mental health and even you sharing your personal experience of going through that, but all the external factors not allowing you to be open about that. What was that like for you? You know, you say devastating, but it would have felt trapped in a way in terms of you're worried about what you're going to do and say, but at the same time, you're dealing with your own mental health issue.
You're absolutely right, Ruben. I just think that when I talk about my chameleon suit, they want you to be normal. They don't want anything to be wrong with you. I'm trying to fit into this perception of what my parents wanted, what my parents-in-law wanted, and what my husband wanted, and trying to act normal so I wouldn't be blocked away again. So, and it just kept compounding the problem, but I didn't know that. I just kept falling down and I didn't realize I was so young at the time and naive, and I had two little children. So therefore another attempt happened, then another attempt. The system was letting me down too, because they weren't grabbing me and saying, there's obviously here a real problem that you've tried three times, but all they did was just write me another script. I just don't think people knew what to do with someone that was in that sort of high risk sort of place at the time. Mine was depression, chronic, every day of my life. I get up and I just wouldn't be happy. I just wouldn't be things. So I just kept going. I kept going and doing the things. So from my perspective, I think that I didn't acknowledge it either. I was half to blame as well, because I was trying to act normal, whatever normal is.
When it was your first step in getting help for the issues and, you know, the depression that you were struggling with, where was that for you and where was that genuine help?
Oh, gosh, it was many, many years. Many years I struggled through the system and kept falling through the gaps. With time and moved to where I am now, and I found the right GP. We could sit down and discuss medication. It was all about me. It was me included in that conversation, which has never been before. It was just write the script and give that to me, and I just had to take them. Whereas you take them for a couple of weeks and then you think you're okay. So the discussion was I had to play my part this time as well. I had to stick with the medication as well. The connection was there straight away. You could build that trust, and that connection was there for me, and I trusted her. I was absolutely devastated when she left, but she passed me on to another GP that was in, because I would go to counsellors here and where I live and psychologists, and then I just couldn't build that rapport with them. I could not think so. I trust my GP. So the next step too after that was there was a suicide forum held here in Port Macquarie back in 2012. I think that building the courage to go along to this meeting, and I think that was another step for me as well, moving to get the right GP, moving to put yourself out there, attending a meeting about suicide makes you vulnerable. It took everything I had to go to that thing. My husband was very supportive, and he said, look, just give it a go. I met some amazing people, and I think that was my second step.
The GP can often be the biggest gateway in terms of being able to get help and how that help might look like. But having that trust with them, I feel, is really invaluable. And being on the phones at Lifeline, we constantly say, have you spoken to your GP? And sometimes they haven't. And it's easier said than done having that conversation. But as you said, you know, having that support around you and feeling when it's the right time and when you think you need to is also important as well.
I think it's very important. I think that that GP should be the first, like I've got, it was a great start for me. That starting point of talking and connecting to your GP first, because then way, get an understanding of how you're feeling and then be able to refer you where you need to go from there. I talk to so many people even now that the GP is the starting point. And I think that's, for me, was really, really big, the trust in someone to talk to. I could talk to her and I could talk about suicide. She's not going to call the ambulance and have me locked away. And that was the fear I had with a lot of them, having that trust so that you can sit there and be totally honest and then find a way forward together.
How did it feel for you after finally being able to realize that you are taking that first step in what you were dealing with and have been?
I wasn't confident at first. I really wasn't. I guess because of the past of what happened, falling through the gaps. We talked about the trust and connection. And once I learned that I was able to have a say in what was going to happen to me and what medications we were, you know, we were, it was all trial and error at the first and that sort of thing. Having a say and having input into your health and my mental health was huge for me. No one's ever done that before. And it's well and truly into my 60s when I moved down here. And I'm thinking it was life-changing for me because it got me on my path to where I am now. It was huge. And I think that the changes that were made included me. And I think that that's a big step for anyone. Sometimes that in the past, they have made these decisions for you. And I think it's very important.
Leah, can you explain what you mean about not taking a one-size-fits-all approach to supporting someone?
This is a real big one with me. I think that if you suffer with bipolar, if you suffer with schizophrenia, you seem to put us in boxes, you know what I mean? And we're all individuals. So one size doesn't fit all. And that was my big first cry. We have different diagnoses, different stories, different traumas, and we need to see the person, women. We really need to see the person, not the diagnosis, and connect with them. And you've got to build that trust rapport. You've got to build that with every individual and to really listen to them and have them as a person, not their diagnosis. You're there to talk to them. When we're sort of having bad days, I think we're all individuals again because we all go down in different ways and things like that. So I think that we need to be treated as people before. I'm a mother of three boys. I'm a grandmother of six grandchildren. That's me first before my diagnosis. When I talk to people, that's what I want to know about them first.
What forms of supports do you draw on now that help you when you're having a difficult time? Your non-negotiables, Leah?
Being honest with myself. That's a big one for me. Not putting on that chameleon suit time. And it really fits very well still if you allow it to, but that's a big one. When I talk to a couple of people at Lifeline, you know, it's stop, you know, just stop for a minute, take a breath, slow down. And I think that they're really good things to listen to. I'm learning to reach out and have the conversation when I'm having a bad day. The suicide prevention manager who I work with at Eclipse is bunker down, just bunker down. So it's bunker down and let it pass. And the old sort of thing is saying it's okay to have that bad day. Before, when I'd have these, I think, oh my God, here we go. And you thought you were going down that spiral in the dark abyss again. You know what I mean? So every time that you start to think, oh, here I go again, but you're able to see if you just stop, let it wash over you and just take a breath, but reach out and talk to someone. It just relieves that pressure. And I think it's really important to sort of say, and there's, so I'm learning that. I'm still learning that, Ruben. I really am. And it takes practice because the old self was there for so long and that was so easy to slip back into. And being positive and not being negative, they're all new things to learn. So I think it's okay to have a bad day. Just don't let it unpack. Just don't let the depression unpack. They're my non-negotiables, Ruben.
I always think on a very simple level and go, everyone's got all their thoughts going on around and around and around in their heads at times. And you don't realize that actually being able to just verbalize it in its most simple form, just talking to someone, forget actually what's being discussed as a subject, but just actually verbalizing it, how much that can make a difference. Yeah. When you've had that vent or you've had that situation where you've just let it all out, sometimes I get it with myself. I'm like, my mindset has completely changed, no matter what the subject was I was talking about, but I've actually just let it out.
We have one of our participants for Eclipse, used to call them distractions. And I like that word, they're coping strategies, but something to distract you. Even if it's just getting up and going, making a cup of tea, or, you know, whatever. I have been really sort of not coping very well. I got up and my husband was sound asleep and I thought, no, I won't wake him. But the action I took was to pick up my phone and text my suicide prevention manager. I knew she wouldn't get it because she switches her phone off, but I knew she'd see it the next day. And that was enough to stop my mind going to the next step. Stop, breathe, do something, but just do something to stop those thoughts my two little dogs, they're a great distraction as well. So just to stop the train of thought, whereas just break it.
We hope you're enjoying this episode. If you're not ready to speak to someone, but would like more information, curated resources, and personal stories to support your journey, please visit toolkit.lifeline.org.au. Now, back to the episode.
What do you do in your day-to-day life that helps manage the frequency and severity of the difficult days that you can have?
Distraction. Over the years, I've built a tool of coping strategies. These strategies need constant updates, as far as I'm concerned, because boredom, it really is my biggest fear of being bored. I think, the thoughts come in, you know, floating around if you're sitting there and got nothing to do. So I feel they can sort of invade my space, my headspace. And I thought, right, so then the negatives come marching in and then you start going to that headspace where you become unwell. So I don't allow to be able to go to that space anymore. So one day it could be writing. The other day it could be ancestry. I love my family history. The best strategy, as I said to you, are my dogs. They run around like madmen and they have the best time and they show you lots of love and affection and they don't answer back. So that's really nice. With a new puppy back in June. Good for me, for my mind. I felt I was getting rather sedentary. So I thought, well, I have to get up to feed him. I have to take him to the toilet. I have to walk him. And it really did change my outlook. It's a living thing that needs my constant thing. So that's given me a purpose, I guess. I'm starting to lose interest in cooking as well. And I said to my husband, we've got to find something else to change of recipes and things like that. And he's getting a bit bored with food. So they're things that take time and we discuss them and they're distractions. So that's my non-negotiables and my difficult days of trying to stop going further down the track. So if I'm sort of sitting there, I think, don't feel like doing that, don't feel like doing that. I have to get up and move. Give any chance for your brain to start that negative coming around. I find it very invading. So I need to keep myself busy.
I feel the word purpose, we can use it always very broadly, but sometimes I like to go pretty micro with it. Getting up in the morning, brushing your teeth, having a shower, it's giving you that purpose, making your bed, which sometimes I don't do from time to time, but I realize the feeling of purpose or that fit that, you know, having that purpose after I've made my bed, it sounds really simple.
But it's huge.
It extends from there.
Absolutely.
Add them into your non-negotiables, you're on to a winner.
Well, I have a diary for things I've got to keep with work-wise, but I have it for my daily achievements as well. Don't write down the making the bed because that's a non-negotiable. I have to do that. I have to have a shower and I have to clean my teeth. Doing the washing the sheets and washing the towels. So I do that on this certain day so I don't forget. So I write things in my diary and I tick them off. And I feel a sense of achievement at the end of the day and I've marked them off. I felt very self-righteous yesterday because I achieved an awful lot yesterday. So that makes you feel really good, you know.
Exactly.
So I think that having a plan of things, but some days you just, you know, someone will be listening to me and saying, oh, but that's all right for you. You're further down the path. And that's fine. That's okay. But only do what you can do. If you can only make your bed for the day, that's fine. That's fine. You've achieved that. So I think that what we're able to do on the day, just to make ourselves feel good about that we've achieved something. The negatives pop in again, don't they? They just bring in and say, look at you. You're sitting around doing nothing. And that's what happens. So, yeah.
I know you touched on it before around the Eclipse program, but just for the listeners and the viewers, what is the Eclipse program? What's your involvement with it? And how did it change your life?
Eclipse is a support group for people who have attempted suicide. It came about by attending that suicide forum and sat next to two wonderful ladies who one had lost a husband and one had lost a son. We had a conversation at lunchtime. They were asking me questions of trying to find some answers for themselves. And I said, that's when my individual talk came in again. I can't answer for your family, but I can only answer for me. They said, please stand up and talk and say that you need a support group. Because if you had a support group, our family may be still alive. And I thought, how very important was that to hear from them. And I will never forget that day, Ruben, I really won't. So I stood up and recounted and I just said, we need a support group because I don't want to be one of those statistics they were talking about. I didn't realise that Lifeline CEO and the Lifeline Matters coordinator was there at the time. I went over and knocked on Lifeline's door here at Port Macquarie and Catherine Vara, the CEO, and Leanne Ford, the Life Matters coordinator at the time, absolutely on the same page. Yes, we want to go with that. So that changed my life. Really, it did, because someone believed in me and someone listened to me. And then the first group started in August of 2016 and I was a participant in that group, Ruben, and it changed my life. We attend 8 weeks. It's a curriculum that we go through and talk. And I was able to talk about suicide. They're sort of fully trained and they're really considerate. You know, you talk about a clinician, but clinicians from Lifeline are just so different. Absolutely different. They've got that Lifeline training behind them. They've got that understanding. You've been trained, so you understand exactly what I'm talking about. In the 2017, Catherine asked to be the peer support. I'd had done my peer support training at TAFE, the mental health peer support. So all that change helped me, that even the TAFE course, doing the peer support course at TAFE, I got so much out of it. Really, I did. And it was just amazing. So I did the course and then I've done a lot of training since then and on the suicide side of it. I just can't explain it properly because I get really excited about it, but I'm so passionate about just helping. I just want to help one person. We've made a difference. Our suicide prevention manager has phone contact with them. They pop in and see her if they want to, or they can see a peer support if they want to. They're supported all along the way. We've still got people from probably the fourth group that's still in contact with us. They all turn up to a Christmas thing and everybody sort of supports one another and is so considerate. This is what's kept me alive as well, Reuben. It really has. It's the passion of the people around me and the consideration and the understanding that they get. You know, you sit there and you listen to these participants and they understand that you get them. That's the word. You get me, don't you? I said, yes, I do. So it's changed me considerably.
Thank you, I suppose, for, you know, off the back of what you've been through and, you know, the life you've lived and experienced, to be able to invest your time and energy with Lifeline. It's, you know, tremendous.
Thank you. But also too, we all fit in a certain place, don't we? You're doing what you need to do. And I'm sure that opportunities will come along as time goes by. You are doing something so positive right now, you know, doing this interview and being on the phone. And I think we all have an ability to make a difference to people's life in our own way.
Exactly. If you could tell your 16-year-old self anything, looking at the life that you've led now, what would it be?
16 would be saying, stop, just take a breath, slow down, and just stop trying to escape from what you don't even know what you're trying to escape from. You know, you have no idea. And I think that's what I did. I kept that chameleon suit, kept going and saying, oh, look, I'll go over here and we'll try that and that'll be better and we'll do this. It'll all change then. And it doesn't. It keeps following you around. And sometimes, I know this is going to sound rather crazy, but sometimes I was trying to pretend I was someone else. Just wanted to get out of your head and just stop that pain. I just think it was really thing. So I think if I could go back and say, just let your mind be still for a minute. I love it when I can get some respite from those horrible thoughts and you know, you get it and you think, and I appreciate that. And it happens more and more now. Just let your mind be still for a minute to be able to say, I need help. And I'm sure if I had done that, maybe I had to do the asking and not my parents coming to me and saying, what do you need? Because they didn't know how. They didn't know what to do for me. I think maybe if I was brave enough to say, I need help, I think that would be a big point, being brave enough. I really think that they are the things to stop, breathe, stop trying to escape, and let your mind be still enough to be able to brave enough to be reach out and just ask. I think so important. We think that we might get into trouble or we do, you know, no one's going to understand. Of course, they're not going to understand, you know, but if we don't take that step to reach out, we're not going to be any sort of better off. If I was talking to someone now young enough to say, just give me a moment, just sit with me for a moment and just give me a moment of your time and just talk to me. I think that would be a big thing. I think if someone had done that to me, I think I would have been much better off. And I'm so glad I am where I am now, though, Reuben. I really am.
And that's good to hear. That's good to hear. And considering the right here and now, what's next for you?
I'm not really quite sure. I was thinking about this. I didn't know I'd be sitting here right now doing this 10 years ago or achieving what I have. So I'm excited to see Eclipse grow and help people like me and keep being involved because that's what keeps me going. So I'm going to keep doing that, Reuben, till I get to the stage where I might need a walking frame. So thanks. But I really enjoy going there on Tuesday and I love meeting the new people and I love seeing them sort of grow and get the support, but also get the understanding. They've been validated. So I think that's what I think I'll keep doing. And I think that's what's next for me, Reuben. Just stay where I am and putter along.
for whatever comes next for you, I honestly do wish you the best. And I suppose to wrap everything up, thank you so much for being part of this, Leah. I'm sure the listeners and the viewers that have taken on your story and your experience with mental health can certainly learn more, but also understand that people can go through the ups and downs, but we can certainly hold on to hope in particular situations and find, you know, the right way that suits them to get that help.
Please reach out. And if you know, I know it's very difficult. We need help. You know, if just acknowledging you just need help, it may be for just a short space of time, but just reaching out that moment when you need it. So, and I do hope that, that someone gets something out of my podcast with you. And thank you for having me. I just would do anything for Lifeline because they've helped me so much. So thank you, Ruben.
And thank you so much for sharing your story with me. I really do appreciate it, Leah.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Holding On to Hope, the podcast. Lifeline is grateful to all Holding On to Hope participants for choosing to share their personal lived experiences openly and courageously in order to offer hope and inspiration to others. Your act of kindness makes for a better world. And remember, if you or someone you know needs crisis support, please phone Lifeline on 13 11 14, text 0477 13 11 14, or visit lifeline.org.au/get help for Lifeline chat service, which is 24/7.